This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A police officer draws a weapon and fires. We see that on TV dramas every night. But what actually happens afterwards? Do investigators check the flight of every bullet? What kind of questions do officers face? And what kind of sanctions if they messed up? What changes if somebody's killed or injured? And what questions will a cop ask him or herself the next night, the next year, for the rest of their lives? If you're a cop, call and tell us what happened after you discharged your weapon. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, a viral video appears to show U.S. Marines urinating on Taliban dead in Afghanistan. Marines, how does this happen? Email us now. The address again is talk@npr.org. But first, what happens after police officers open fire? We begin with David Klinger, a former cop in Los Angeles and Redmond, Washington. He now teaches criminology and wrote about the use of deadly force in his book, Into the Kill Zone, and joins us by phone from Houston. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks much for having me on again.
And this is both your area of study and your story.
Yes, it is.
What happened?
When I was a young police officer in Los Angeles, 4 months out of the academy, a crazy guy with a knife tried to murder my partner, stabbed him in the chest, knocked him on the ground. I was on the other side of the street. As I'm running across the street, the suspect jumped on top of my partner and tried to drive the knife through his throat. My partner managed to grab the suspect's wrists and prevent that from happening. When I got to my partner's side a few seconds later, I tried to disarm the suspect, wasn't able to, and had to shoot him.
And it sounds like there couldn't be anything more clear-cut, yet I suspect you've been thinking about that off and on ever since.
Not ever since, but it took me about 20 years. The first 20 years, there were some difficult moments, and then about 10 years ago, I said, you know what, Dave, it does nobody any good. The situation's behind, and as you pointed out, Neil, there really wasn't anything else that could be done. And I came to peace with it, and I've been fine ever since.
Now, as you have approached this from a professional standpoint, did you find a lot of studies of police officers and how they used their weapons and what happened afterwards?
There hadn't been a lot of studies back in the late 90s, which is what led me to do the study that I did that led to my book. And basically for Killzone, what I did, it was a study that was funded by the United States Department of Justice, interviewed 80 cops around the nation who'd been involved in shootings, and one of the things I asked them about was what happened in the aftermath. And to make a very long story short, The vast majority of officers in the short term have some notable disruption in terms of intrusive thoughts, in terms of maybe an inability to sleep or something like that. But after a few weeks, for most officers, those problems dissipate, and so the long-term consequences for most officers are actually quite good. Only about 20% of the officers had any sort of negative consequence that lingered past 3 months.
And in the majority of cases, as in the vast majority of cases, as in your case, the investigation that succeeds an incident like that finds that the officer was not at fault, did nothing wrong. But these are tricky moments for a police officer, no?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, my situation was, as you pointed out, clear-cut. I knew exactly what I was dealing with. It was an individual who was trying to murder a fellow officer. Sometimes it's not so clear-cut. I've been involved in numerous situations when I was a young officer where I could have shot but decided not to because the posture of the suspect, because the way he or she was manipulating the gun in their hand, that type of thing. And also circumstances where officers shoot, they think there's a gun, it turns out there's not a gun, then it becomes highly problematic. So,
a case just in Texas in the last couple of weeks of an eighth grader holding a realistic-looking toy, and it turns out that he was shot to death. Obviously, we're going to have to wait for the investigation to find out all the details there, but this happens too often, and wow, those officers must feel terrible.
Yeah. You know, police officers sign up to protect the public from dangerous threats. And when, as in the case you just mentioned, everything appears to look like I have a serious threat. Here's an individual who has brought a gun to school. guns are our sanctuaries. We cannot let this individual kill children. And then it turns out that it is a mock gun or a replica gun or a toy gun. That's got away very difficult on the officers. And, some of the 80 officers that I interviewed for Killzone had been involved in circumstances where they shot people fully believing that the suspect was armed with a deadly weapon, and it turned out it was a replica or something. And the officers had a very, very difficult time dealing with that.
Joining us now is Lawrence Maurer, a reporter with the Las Vegas Review-Journal. He wrote a series last year on the use of deadly force by police officers. Among those he spoke with was David Klinger, who's also with us today. And he joins us now from KNPR in Las Vegas. Nice to have you on the program with us today.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
And I was interested, just given what David Klinger was just saying, yes, I think we hear about it often when police officers fire their weapons with tragic results. We don't hear about it when they don't.
No, that's true, absolutely. And these are still relatively rare incidents. Here we found that, Metro Police, Las Vegas Metro Police, the big agency here, fires their weapons at people around 17 times a year. And they are relatively rare incidents.
And relatively rare. Nevertheless, it seems that at least there, the investigations that follow have, is it fair to say, universally cleared officers?
Almost. What we found was that, one, there was a lot of shootings here. Also that the department was very reluctant to learn from its incidents, learn from its shootings, and that they were reluctant to hold officers accountable for them. And really, the review process in place was fairly lax. In the last decade, Metro's review board had cleared 99% of officers who were involved in any kind of incident, serious incident like a shooting. The criminal review process was fairly lax also.
Reluctant to do that because they feared for morale? Because why?
Well, it's interesting. For the board that they had set up here, and they still do have set up here, was dominated by citizens. And what we found kind of interesting is we talked to the citizens, and they were very much very pro-police. They had difficulty holding officers accountable for these incidents. Oftentimes it was the officers on the board who were harder on their own officers than the citizens were. But, what you've heard over time from police also is that, well, we don't want to second guess another officer's decision to use deadly force because these incidents are so rare and they're not as clear cut often as, an officer beating someone up. Well, many officers would not justify that. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask David Klinger to come in and say, is the experience there in Las Vegas, do you think, replicated across much of the country?
In terms of the sense that most shootings are held to be justified?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And a dispassionate observer who looked at the investigative case files of the vast majority of shootings would have to come to the same conclusion. There are some bad shootings. There's no doubt about that. And when I say a bad shooting, I mean one where a police officer didn't make either a good faith mistake or some other thing that would come up that we would say, gosh, we don't like this. We wish it hadn't happened, but it's perfectly justified. There's a term of art called awful but lawful. So sometimes officers are involved in shootings that don't really sound that good, but the law says it was an appropriate use of force. So if you take the ones where it's clear-cut justified, then some of these other ones, there's only going to be a few where an officer is clearly out of bounds.
Let's get a caller in involved in the conversation. We want to hear from police officers today. What happened after you fired your weapon? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Jeff is on the line with us from Houston. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Well, this happened a few years ago while I was in narcotics. On my way home after shift, car driving erratic early in the morning, pulled the guy over just to, see what was going on. When I came back with his license, he fired rounds into my chest. So, of course, I fired back. He ended up that became fatal. And after my paid time off and everything, for their investigation, it was justified. But I guess it was more hard for me to get over because of the age and that it was just, I had lots of friends with kids that age, and it was just, to this day, it's still hard.
I assume you were wearing a Kevlar vest?
That it went through.
It went through?
It was where I got hit with armored rounds. Unfortunately, they figured out afterwards, about a month later, that he had picked them up off of a friend that his dad was military. And that's where, apparently, he got them from. So, you know, he hadn't been in any trouble, nothing. And I was just, you know, I was going to give a verbal warning. And I was out.
I'm afraid we're losing your cell phone, Jeff. Are you okay? Are you doing okay? I think we've lost him, and I apologize. We certainly hope Jeff is doing okay and can understand his anguish. This is an email we have from Isaac in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm an attorney for a police union in Minnesota. I was also living in New York City at the time of the Amadou Diallo shooting, which was widely portrayed as an example of trigger-happy cops. Now that I've worked with police for several years, I have a much better appreciation for the dangers they face and the split-second decisions they have to make. I don't know if the Diallo shooting was justified, but I know now just how complex some of these cases really are. And David Klinger, that, of course, was the case where a man in the Bronx was thought to have a weapon and was, I think, hit 41 times.
Yeah. To make a very long story short, the officers believed that they were dealing with a criminal who was pulling a gun on them, and it turned out that he was pulling a wallet. And that's one of those ones of, you know, lawful but awful, where the officer misperceives. I've written about it, and Malcolm Gladwell in his book Blink gives a very, very good detailed account of how it is that the officers came to perceive it the way that they did. And anybody that's interested in learning about that particular case would do well to take a look at that chapter in the book Blink.
We're talking about what happens when police use deadly force. If you're a cop, call and tell us what happened after you discharged your weapon. 800-989-8255. You can send us an email, talk@npr.org. We'll have more in just a minute. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. When police officers respond to a call, enter the home of a suspect, or even make a routine traffic stop, they never know what might happen next. In New Orleans this morning, police investigating a shooting inside a house tracked a vehicle they believed contained the gunman. New Orleans PD says one of those in that vehicle opened fire on police. That person was then shot and killed by police officers. An investigation will inevitably follow. So police officers, tell us what happened after you fired your weapon. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guest is David Klinger, a former police officer with the Los Angeles and Redmond, Washington police departments. And Lawrence Maurer, a reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, is also with us. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Bert. Bert with us from Reno.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
Hey, I have a different perspective on this entire scenario in that I was a supervisor here in Nevada for the Nevada Highway Patrol, and I do believe firmly that training the officers that work on that department will keep the number of shootings to a minimum, and they know when they can fire their weapon and when they should not fire that weapon. And I'm not saying for one moment that officers should jeopardize their safety by not firing when necessary. However, there are instances where by law you can fire that weapon and kill someone, and it could have totally been avoided.
I understand that. In your police department, were there investigations?
Absolutely, there were investigations.
Were you in charge of them?
I was in charge of some of those.
And that must be very difficult to investigate your fellow officers.
It is difficult. However, right is right and wrong is wrong. And I might be the minority when it comes to law enforcement officers, but I believe that the citizens that you serve should be provided with highly trained professionals so that in the event of a shooting, the question as to whether that officer was justified or not could be minimized.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Bert. And Lawrence Maurer, you wrote in your series in the Las Vegas Review-Journal several instances in which officers would have been perfectly justified by law and by circumstance to have opened fire, did not, and proved to be right.
No, that's true. And your caller brings up a good point in that, you know, the vast majority of these things are legally justified and perhaps even morally justified, too, in the vast majority of the time. But what we found is that some of them can be avoided through tactics and really looking at, okay, did the officer place themselves in a position of danger? For example, we had a case here where officers trying to apprehend a person who was fencing stolen goods. They caught him coming out of the store. The suspect jumped into the passenger side of a car. One officer went to the passenger side of the car to try to pull him out. Well, the driver took off. And now the officer's in a situation where they're being dragged. And the officer is in a situation where either you shoot to kill the driver and stop the car, or you let go and be crushed by the car potentially.
A difficult choice.
Absolutely. And that's a case where, you know, the officer was certainly legally justified and had no other option in that situation. But nevertheless, it could have been avoided. And other departments have policies that say don't reach into running or basically don't reach into vehicles. Well, Las Vegas police don't have that kind of policy.
There was also a finding that you made that suggested that police officers involved in shootings, if they're involved in several shootings, well, yes, circumstances can mount and someone can be unfortunate, but nevertheless, it does seem to form a pattern.
Well, sometimes. What we found was that some officers in a lot of shootings are in, for example, the SWAT team, where you might be more prone to have a lot of shootings, and you can't really make a moral judgment based on that or, you know, a personnel judgment. But what we did find is that patterns of officers being involved in multiple shootings, sometimes they had other disciplinary problems, and some of those shootings were problematic, to say the least. One cop we looked at was involved in 3 fatal shootings in 5 years, and in each of those shootings, the person who was shot was a vagrant. There were no witnesses to any of the shootings, and the officer's judgment was highly questionable by people inside and outside the department. And yet the officer was allowed to stay on for a number of years until he was fired for disciplinary reasons.
David Klinger, is it widespread that, as Lawrence Mower says in the case in Las Vegas, that police departments are reluctant to try to draw lessons from their shooting incidents?
Well, what I found is that most of the agencies around the country are actually quite interested in drawing lessons. And, for example, my old agency, Los Angeles, one of the things that they have been doing for many years is having essentially a tactical review of the incident to say what could the officers have done differently, if anything, in order to either reduce the likelihood of a shooting or to reduce the likelihood of collateral damage, citizen being damaged, injured, so on and so forth. In fact, I'm presently involved in a project with the Bureau of Justice Assistance, another branch of United States Department of Justice, where I'm interviewing officers around the country and asking them, what are the lessons that we can learn from your incident? And this is going to be fed back into American law enforcement. This is at the highest levels of U.S. DOJ. And so my experience is that most agencies really do want to learn from what goes on in shootings. And, in fact, as I indicated, that's something that the federal government is involved in currently.
Let's get another caller in. This is John. John with us from Southern California.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed that the person you're interviewing isn't talking about is the way that police officers are treated after the shooting. It almost feels adversarial in nature. I was involved in a shooting myself a few hours off of training. It was covered by national news, and it was a huge incident. And, there was no doubt that I was in the right, but still the fact they take your gun away while you're on scene, they put you in a patrol car, they separate the different people in the shootings. There's a way that they do it, but it just really feels like they're treating me like a criminal. I'd like them to speak a little bit about that.
David Klinger?
Well, that's unacceptable. One of the things that I do and other people around the country do is train agencies about post-shooting protocols. And to disarm an officer at the scene, there's no reason for that. There's a time and a place to get the officer's weapon for evidence collection, and that's back at the station once the officer is safe. Once the scene is secured, so on and so forth, there's got to be some sort of an adversarial process because there's always the question in our democracy whether an officer used deadly force appropriately, so there has to be a careful investigation of the facts. However, it doesn't have to be adversarial in the sense of trying to make it look as if the officer did something wrong. When I say adversarial, the district attorney has to take a look at it, make sure everything is squared away. But I agree with the officer. If an agency is not treating the officer with the respect that they deserve, because after all, what happens is they trained the officer, they hired the officer, they gave him a gun, they said go out, and under these circumstances, deadly force is appropriate. Unless and until there is some evidence that the officer did something wrong, the officer shouldn't be treated like a criminal suspect.
John, how long ago was this?
I was back in 2005.
Do you think procedures have changed?
You know, after that happened, I'm sure they probably did. I've talked to other departments, and they also said the same thing that that Mr. Klinger said. It's just I'm not sure how often that happens. That was just my my take on the incident, what happened with me and with the other officers. There were actually five officers involved. 38 shots were fired, and eight of them hit him, and he still lived.
And the person you were firing at?
Yeah, the person still lived. They had to put him in a coma for a few days, and then he came back out of the coma. He had double the amount of crystal meth that you would expect on a suspect.
And were all the officers okay?
Yeah, all of them were fine.
And how long did this process take, all told?
Let's see, it started about 5 o'clock in the morning. We were probably done by around noon or 1 o'clock.
And then how long did the investigation take? How long was it before you got your weapon back?
Well, they give you a week on the beach or, you know, administrative leave for a week, and then you come back. You have to go see a psych first to make sure that you're okay, and that was pretty much it.
And have you had any difficulties?
No, no problems at all. I think that just the main thing, and I just felt the way that they treated me at the time, but I'm glad that Mr. Klinger spoke to that, that wasn't correct.
All right, John, thanks very much. Appreciate the phone call.
Thank you.
And Lawrence Maurer, that procedure he described, a week on the beach, administrative leave, is that what they do in Las Vegas too?
That's kind of the norm nationwide, is that you give officers time to see a psychologist and really make sure you're okay. Because it's interesting, one of your earlier callers kind of talked about this, was I talked to a cop who was involved in combat in Vietnam, and he was later involved in police shootings. And he said that, you know, in combat, not that it's not traumatic, but that you often don't know who you're shooting. You don't know anything about that person. But if you're a police officer, you're going to find out everything there is to know about that guy usually through the press and through your own your department's investigation. You'll know that that person had a family, had loved ones, was loved by someone. And it's in my interviews with officers, a lot of them really struggled with that.
And David Klinger, we find, again, our experience with the military is that there is a degree of, first of all, denial, and then there's a degree of soldiers and Marines unwilling to report for counseling because, they fear what it's going to make them look like to their fellow soldiers and Marines, and what's also they don't want to be pulled out of the line of duty. Does the same kind of syndrome affect police officers?
I don't know that we could call it a syndrome in terms of how widespread it is, but certainly in my first study that I did for the Department of Justice, the one that led into the kill zone, several officers did mention that they did not feel comfortable talking to anybody in the organization, particularly the police psychologist or psychiatrist, because they did not believe that they would be treated well, i.e. they might be pulled off the line, someone might think that they weren't capable of doing their jobs. And so, yes, that there is, at least for some officers, a sense that because it could redound negatively on them professionally, that they want to keep stuff close to the vest as opposed to going and getting the help that perhaps they might need.
We're talking with David Klinger, a former police officer with the Los Angeles Police Department and the Police Department in Redmond, Washington. He's currently a professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. He's with us by phone in Houston. His book is Into the Kill Zone. Lawrence Maurer is also with us, a reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. His series on deadly force ran in the Review-Journal last November. He's with us from the studios of Nevada Public Radio in Las Vegas. We also spoke earlier about the case of Amadou Diallo in New York, and I misspoke. There were 41 shots fired. He was hit 19 times, and a caller came in with a correction. We thank them for that. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can go next to Chet, and Chet's with us from Moultrie in Georgia.
Hi.
Hi, Chip. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Sorry, I had you on speaker. Boy, my attitude's changed listening to everybody call. I've been through two, and they were both completely different. And I don't even know where to start. I get all emotional talking about it.
Well, tell us about the first one.
Well, the first one was just something that a police officer probably would have no problem dealing with. It was an inmate trying to escape, and he was also a mental patient. He grabbed another officer's gun and shot that officer in the face right in front of me and then fired a shot at me, and then he ran out, and I chased him out, and eventually, well, there was a lot of shooting back and forth, and he was eventually shot. That was obviously one of those cut-and-dried situations. The second one was not. The first one happened early when I was in my 20s. The second one happened in 2005, like the officer you just talked to a few minutes ago,
mm-hmm.
late in my career. And it turns out the guy was trying to rob a Coke machine, of all things, and I thought he was trying to, I thought the thing had taken his money, so I came up unprepared for an aggressive personality, and when he thought that I was there to arrest him, because I didn't know it, but in his vehicle, which was parked there, were items that he had taken from a burglary.
I see.
And so he assumed that I knew that, and at first he tried to stab me with a screwdriver. I used pepper spray in that situation. And then while he was under the influence of the pepper spray, I was trying to handcuff him, and he managed to knock me down, get in the car, and it was one of the situations you talked about earlier. I was being dragged. So I climbed up into the car in his lap, and the car was going backwards in a circle. And he managed to, I was trying to hold on to keep the centrifugal force from throwing me out of the open door. And he, while I was doing that, he grabbed my gun. And then when I realized he had my gun, then we both struggled for the gun. And I had the advantage of pressure being on top. And so that's how it ended up.
That sounds terrifying, to tell you the truth. The investigation that time, how long did that take?
The investigation took, the first time, obviously, it was completely different. The second time, in Georgia, we have the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, and when they got there, I actually knew a lot of the, well, I knew all the agents who were there. They arrived shortly after. And as a police officer, when they sit you down to interview after a shooting, you expect that, but when they read you Miranda, you're not expecting that.
I bet not, no.
I didn't know what to do at that point. And so obviously, when you hear Miranda, you don't know what they're thinking. So I did get an attorney. Everything turned out okay. And another ironic twist in my situation, we're in South Georgia. I was a white officer. The suspect was black. And the family immediately said that racism was involved. But the organization that saved me really was the NAACP.
Yeah, and how did that happen? We just have a few seconds left.
Well, real quickly, I was born and raised here. I've been in law enforcement here my whole life, and apparently someone from the national organization came down to conduct an inquiry, and when he talked with the representatives from chapters in two local communities where I had worked, they basically told him they knew me, they knew my family, they knew my work history, and I had, in 25 years, I'd never had a
mm-hmm.
plane of racism or excessive force, and then the boy had an extensive record, so he got on the plane and went home. So.
Well, Chet, thanks very much for the call. We hope you're doing okay.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. And David Klinger, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
David Klinger, former police officer in Los Angeles and Redmond, Washington, now at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. And our thanks to Lawrence Maurer of the Las Vegas Review-Journal at Nevada Public Radio in Las Vegas. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
After a short break, more about the controversial video that allegedly shows four Marines desecrating corpses in Afghanistan. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.